Now invite your close attention to Brother Brian as he leads us in the study of Isaiah chapter 27.
Citizen, our dear young people, Bible class has a very special value for us in our ecclesial life, and it's very nice to be starting off this class again as 1995 opens upon us. We are very anxious that our Bible class this year is significant and relevant, that it's interesting and educational. Sunday morning is a time of exhortation. That's what we call it, isn't it? It's an exhortation. Sunday night we preach to those without. And Wednesday night is a teaching night. Our Bible class needs to have that element about it. That is a teaching night. I don't know how you feel, but I come to Bible class because I really want to learn something. I enjoy learning something. That's our night particularly for learning something. Something that we may not have known so well before. And of course, this makes it a very important time because we may not have much time left. It's a matter of great moment to us, surely, that we now, having turned into 1995, have only 5 years before the end of this millennium. Perhaps 5 years to the millennium, who knows. But it's not many people, is it, that really have passed from one millennium to another. And as far as the era of Christ is concerned, it's only happened to one other generation. Those who went from 1999, sorry, let's have it, isn't it? Those who went from 999 to 1,000. It's interesting to note, when you look back at history, that when that happened, lots of people had all kinds of forebodings as to what was going to happen when the year 1,000 finally turned on the clock. And I suppose it's very likely, it's already happening, that people are looking now to the year 2,000. And in an era of the earth's history that has had no precedent whatsoever, it's natural that people seeing the vastness of the problems and the hugeness of mankind's complexity and the smallness relatively of the earth are thinking the year 2000, that really is something. Well, the other day I read a little extract about how the papacy is viewing the year 2000, and it was really mind tingling. I want to read you this little bit, which appeared in the Time magazine for December the 26th to January the 2nd. I think it was the issue which had the Man of the Year, John Paul II, the Man of the Year. Now listen to this. John Paul's ambitions for the millennial year are vast. They're thinking 5 years ahead. You know, our ranging brethren met during the week before, and I just thought, well, how far ahead are our plans, eh? We're up perhaps to our special effort. We've got a Sunday school camp coming up. We've got a few things in mind, but 5 years ahead? John Paul's ambitions for the millennial year are vast. He dreams of having a summit of all monotheistic religions at Mount Sinai, and of concelebrating a mass with Patriarch Alexei II of Moscow to mark the reconciliation of Roman Catholicism with Russian Orthodoxy. Now that's stunning, isn't it? You just to think of the effect of that upon Israel. There's Israel trying to keep their holy sites and to govern them as they see and to control their country and have Jerusalem, and he is planning an international congress of all monotheistic peoples, even though they worship the Trinity, of all monotheistic peoples at Mount Sinai, and in particular of concelebrating a union of the Catholic and Orthodox churches at Mount Sinai in that very year. And what happens when Israel says, no, you can't do this and that with Jerusalem? When you've got forces like that, you might say the Latin West and the Slavic East joined together, not only in politics, but now a planning of joining them together in religion, which will give a great credence or sanctify that union as nothing else would. Isn't that a colossal concept? Last month, the Pope issued an apostolic letter on preparing the year 2000, in which he asked Catholics to reflect on all those times in history when they departed from the Spirit of Christ and the Gospel. Specifically, he suggested that the Church needs to repent for its sometimes intolerant treatment of other faiths. That notion shocked some bishops, who would have preferred that the Pope emphasise the accomplishments of the Church. I don't think we'll see that, my dear brothers and sisters, because Revelation 16 says that it's a system that goes into destruction and it knows no repentance. And in fact, it repeats it three times. Very interesting. Now, this rather interesting caricature portrays the United States and Europe. Here's America and here's Catholic Europe. And they've come to have a cup of tea, but they're actually, in fact, hiding behind their papers. And that caricature, that cartoon, appeared in The Economist and shows very clearly the departure of the ways between the United States and Catholic Europe, which is really exactly what we would expect. More than that, here in the paper called The European, we have this heading: if Britain left the Union, would anyone really care? Now, how many years have we been talking about the possibility and need for Britain, if she's going to have an independent role, as Ezekiel says she will, to come out of Europe and to have her own role? How many years have we been saying that? Look at that. If Britain left the Union, European Union that means, would anyone really care? So Europe is ready to see her go. They're not the slightest bit concerned. And earlier in the month, Foreign Minister of England, Norman Lamont, former Foreign Minister, told a packed fringe meeting at the annual Conservative Party conference that he could cite no practical way in which the European Union membership benefited the country. There was not a shred of evidence that the other EU nations shared Britain's anti-federalist views on the future of the Union. In other words, they're moving towards Union. Britain doesn't want to go any further than she has gone. They want a common currency, they want a common bank, they want a common parliament. Britain wants none of that. But none of those in there are interested in her concepts. She alone thinks that way. And Lamont says, who was finance minister, he says, I can't see one good reason economically why, in fact, Britain should stay in. Events are driving Major towards a game of brinkmanship. By the next intergovernmental talks in 1996, Helmut Kohl will be only 2 years from retiring as German Chancellor, and consequently hell-bent, excuse the term, on one last push to make his vision of a federal Europe a reality. In Britain, the general election could well be fought on that year over the issue of Europe. Labour and its youthful leader pursuing a pro-European line, and the jaded Conservatives backing on a, quote, we defend Britain's interests ticket to strike a chord with the ordinary voter. Well, they're startling pieces of information, aren't they? Absolutely startling. So this might be the last series of Bible classes that we have, my dear brothers and sisters, as we consider the rapidity with which things are happening. Now, Brother Philip has passed around a précis of the chapter, which you have there. This 27th chapter of Isaiah. There are, in fact, four divisions of the chapter. The first is in verse 1, and each of these divisions presents a picture to us. And in the brochure that you have, in the sheet that you have, we have indicated that the first one of those pictures in verse 1 may be headed up by the title, The Slaying of Leviathan by Yahweh's Sword. In that day, Yahweh with his sore and great and strong sword, dramatic language, shall punish Leviathan. He will slay Leviathan, that dragon in the sea. Now, in verses 2 to 6, the theme is quite different. In verses 2 to 6, we are presented with a most luxurious, a flourishing vineyard, altogether different to the sense of verse 1. It is a vineyard of red wine. That is the picture produced for us in verse 2, and from verses 2 to 6 is about that vineyard and its flourishing. And then going back over things, partly reminiscing and explaining things, we have in verses 7 to 11 another section, entirely different again, which we have headed up as the purging of Jacob's sin. The purging of Jacob's sin. It's a kind of explanation of all that they have gone through that has brought them finally to that time of flourishing indicated in verse 6. The heading of our chapter tonight, or our study tonight, Israel shall blossom and bud. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. And so after that magnificent statement, does it have an equal? Does verse 6 have an equal as far as the fortunes of Israel are concerned? It's a very full and wonderful expression. And then in verses 7 to 11, we have a reflection and meditation about what she had gone through to reach that point, verses 7 to 11. And then in the final two verses, there is this note of regathering. Because if they were scattered, then there needed to be a gathering. If their cities, verse 10, were, even their defence cities, were left desolate and their habitation forsaken and left like a wilderness, then it's not just a matter of regeneration, there must be regathering as well. And so verses 12 and 13 provide that understanding. A trumpet, a great trumpet, as it's termed in verse 13, will be blown. It shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown. And they shall come from the north and from the south and shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. I'd just like to turn to a passage which we know very well, but it's got great relevance to us in our considerations of Isaiah, keeping our hand in our chapter we're considering. Have a look, my dear brothers and sisters, at 1 Peter chapter 1. Of which salvation, Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 10, of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you. Now that's an intriguing verse. It's saying that although the prophets gave the message, they didn't automatically understand its import. They thought about it. They inquired and searched diligently. For they were prophesying of something to come. They prophesied of the grace that should come unto you, of which salvation the prophets had inquired. That was the grace that provided salvation. So there was salvation involved in the words of the prophets. That is how God would provide salvation through grace to his people. And they were intrigued to see those references. Now when you think of salvation provided in the prophets, what book above all books must surely reflect that? Well, it's got to be Isaiah, doesn't it? Isaiah means the salvation of Yahweh. It's the very meaning of the book. And it's the king of the prophets, so to speak. It sits as the most remarkable book of all the books of the prophets. And so again in verse 11, searching what or what manner of time did these prophets, inquiring as to what it meant. You can see Isaiah giving his chapter and then turning to it, like we are tonight, saying, well, how do we analyse that chapter that he has spoken by the Spirit of God? How do I analyse that? What relevance to the present? What are the applications later on? How is it to be worked out? What's the timing of this event against that event? Searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ, which was in them, did signify. So when we study the prophets, we are not studying something exceptional to Christ, exclusive of Christ, quite the reverse. The Spirit of Christ is in Isaiah. We know that particularly, like for example in chapter 53, but this is not just saying chapter 53, is it? It's saying that the Spirit of Christ is in Isaiah, And it's our glory to be able to bring that through to the surface and be able to see the working of God in that. And of course, we've never been in a better time to do that, have we? Never been. It was very difficult to do that before Christ came the first time. Extremely difficult. The prophets themselves found it difficult. So, verse 12, did the angels. Unto whom, unto the prophets, it was revealed that not unto themselves, but unto us, the apostles and those of his generation, they did minister the things which are now reported unto you by them that have preached the gospel unto you with the Holy Spirit sent down from heaven, which things the angels desire to look into. So even the angels above who saw Isaiah writing those things and were sometimes involved in the very giving of the message, they too would turn around and say to each other, "What I wonder, what does that mean? How will it work out in its own time?" And Peter says, that was kept for you, for that generation of his day and the day of the apostles. So now we are 1900 years down the track, aren't we? And that means that these prophecies are extremely relevant to us. And so if you think that you're in the middle of the prophecy of Isaiah and you're not very familiar with those pages and that it's pretty hard going to come to grips with them, that may be inspirational, my dear brothers and sisters. Inspirational in so much that God gave it for people to exercise their minds and to be interested in those things and to come to grips with them and master them. So they're not a group of people, shallower brute, but we've got a deep hold upon the scriptures. We are interested in the scriptures. We want to know. We're not happy to be ignorant, as the rest of the world might be. You could stand on Rundle Street and say, who knows something about Isaiah 27? There wouldn't be one person, 10,000 that passed. They would know anything about it, would they? Probably wouldn't want to know what Isaiah was, half of them. But we're not like that. And it is inspirational to notice, as we mentioned in the notice on Sunday, that the chapter itself is the basis of at least two chapters in the New Testament. Think about that. One is Romans chapter 11. And the other is the book of Revelation, chapter 20. Sections of this, of its understanding, is taken straight into those chapters. And you could perhaps add another third chapter, John 15, to that as well. Now what that means to me is that we are in very good company. I find that really inspiring. As I sit at my desk and I'm trying to come to grips with this, I can see, as it were, over my shoulder, you know, a young lad in Nazareth who wanted to know. He was reading that and considering what the prophecy meant. So that when later on he gives, for example, Revelation chapter 20 and also 17 and 18 and chapter 12 and chapter 22, all of those chapters have got lots and lots of quotations from these very chapters that we've been looking at. Now, isn't that a thrill? Isn't that something of great moment? Isn't that something to be desired, my dear brothers and sisters, that we are in fact in very great company? Special, it's a special privilege. You say to me, well, I don't know much about Isaiah 27. Of course we don't, by nature. But we don't, we ought to. He sat up there and he worked upon that till he could see the meaning of those things. We are in great company. And it behoves us to take the opportunities seriously and appreciate our privilege. Or to see the Apostle Paul as he's turning over in his mind about the fortunes of the Jews. And he comes to this chapter and just loads Romans 11 with passages from here. Would you ever have believed that? How important is Romans chapter 11? It's the chapter, isn't it, as far as the future of the Jews is concerned. Is there a more important chapter? There is not. Because whatever else is found in the Old Testament, Romans 11 is the Old Testament brought into the New Testament. Same story about the destiny of Israel told in eloquent and wonderful ways, but the foundations of Romans 11 rest in the prophets, and a great deal of them rest in Isaiah 27. How would you be getting on with talking to people who try to tell you, for example, that Israel is now spiritual, has nothing to do with the natural seed of Jacob? If we didn't have Romans 11 in our Bible, how would you get on? I can tell you from a lot of experience, you'd be really hard put. Because on all of the passages, they just swing straight over. Jerusalem, which is the mother of us all. The Israel of God, the true Israel. He is not a Jew who is one inwardly, not one outwardly, but one inwardly. All of those passages, they just switch them straight over and say you've got nothing left. But you can't do that with Romans 11. You can't. And the reason is that Romans 11 is pillared, just based solidly upon the prophets. And because of that application, the apostolic application of all those different passages, we therefore can go back to those prophets with equal confidence and say, look, I'm sorry, the Apostle Paul has told us what that chapter means. And so we've got a case for the hope of Israel. There will be a gathering of God's people into a time of great blessing. So our study's got tremendous relevance to our lives and to our faith, this wonderful book of Isaiah. Now the heading for verse 1 was the slaying of a Leviathan by Yahweh's sword. I want you to notice the summary nature of this verse. There are four expressions which may at first seem to be entirely unnecessary. Why are they given? In that day, Yahweh will, with his sore and great, his hard, that word sore means, his hard sword. It's been fire hardened. And his great and strong sword. He shall punish four things. Leviathan, the piercing serpent. They're obviously the same thing, aren't they? Leviathan, the piercing serpent. Even Leviathan, that crooked serpent. That twisting, winding serpent. And he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. Now that's not saying that all those things are different. It's saying, my dear brothers and sisters, in a summary way, that all those things are the same. So we have Leviathan. We have the serpent. Sometimes spoken of as crooked. What's the other adjective for him? Pardon? Piercing. Then it also describes this system as the dragon. And that's interesting, because it puts them all together in one summary statement. They're not different things. It's just using a lot of terms to speak about the same essential system. The piercing serpent really means the swift serpent. So the revised version actually translates it that way. The swift serpent. The crooked or twisting serpent. And then that's aligned with the dragon in the sea. Now that is very similar to a passage in Revelation chapter 12, isn't it? In which all these forces of evil, all this description of evil, Revelation chapter 12, his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, verse 3. There appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven. But then in verse 9, he's put in together with all these other titles, which are very similar to what we've got in Isaiah 27, verse 1. The great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the Diabolos and Satan. Dragon, serpent, Diabolos, Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. That's a very, very similar passage of scripture. The burden in both cases might be different, the application might be different, but you can see that there's a very interesting correlation of terms involved in Isaiah 27, as we have also there in Revelation 7-9. Well, in what day is it? What's the timing for the use of Yahweh's strong and sore sword. Isaiah 27 verse 1 says, in that day Yahweh will do these things against this summary system. In that day. What day is that then? Well, it takes us back to verse 21 of chapter 26. For behold, Yahweh cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. That must be about the same expression, mustn't it? Yahweh cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. So what is said in verse 1, characteristic language, in symbolical language, is really said in plain English in verse 21 of chapter 26. What day is this then? Well, it goes on to say in verse 21, the earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no more cover her slain. Which means it's the day of resurrection. And that's confirmed as we run up a little bit further into that same chapter. See verse 19. Do you remember that this was one of the most wonderful statements of resurrection? Beautiful statement. Thy dead men, verse 19, thy dead men shall live. Together with my dead body shall they arise, says Isaiah, in a personal statement of hope of resurrection. Thy dead men shall live. Together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, ye that dwell in dust, for thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. So it's a statement, a time of resurrection, as indicated by verse 19 and by verse 21. So this great and sore sword of Yahweh in chapter 27 verse 1 is going to be exercised at the time of the resurrection. It's related to that time. Now why does then Isaiah use this term Leviathan? It's an actual factor. It's a transliteration of the name. It's a Hebrew word that we've just sort of borrowed. The Hebrew word goes something like this. Leviathan, which you can see we have just transliterated that across. That's not the case with the other words that he used there, but it is that one, and the reason is that it's sort of peculiar to the Hebrew. And so not having a translation of it, an easy translation, it's been carried over. The great description of Leviathan, of course, is found in Job, isn't it? Let's just have a look at that very quickly. Job 41. There's a whole chapter here dealing with Leviathan. It was one of those not able to hear. Thanks, Wayne. As soon as you walked away, Wayne, it moved almost like in defiance. I thought there might have been a serpent there for a moment. In Job 41, verse 1, we have a whole chapter which is dealing with Leviathan, of God's great power in the Leviathan. It was put before Job to evoke in him a sense of inferiority and humility before God. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with an hook, or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down? Canst thou put a hook into his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Verse 4, wilt thou play with him as with a bird? Shall the companions make a banquet of him? It's interesting that Leviathan comes from the word Levi, which means to join, doesn't it? The Levites really had that sense because they joined the nation to God. So Leviathan is from Levi. When Levi's mother, who was not Rachel, but Leah, when Leah had the child Levi, she called him such because she felt so happy about the new child, and because he had brought a number of children to her husband, that then he might be joined to her in a special way above the other alternatives. So that's the meaning that she gave to Levi, but in point of time, that changed, and Levi came to mean joining that nation to God because they were close to God. They were the nation upon which they could rely. Now, the Leviathan here in Job 41 may well have its name because of the cohesion of all the parts of this creature. See here in verse 14. Who can open the doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. His scales are his pride, shut up together as with a close seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. So he's joined. They are joined, verse 17, one to another. It's the very sense of Leviathan. They stick together that they cannot be sundered. By his meeting, kneesings, a light doth shine, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. So he's tremendously ferocious, tremendous strength. Darts are counted as stubble, verse 29. He laugheth at the shaking of a spear. Sharp stones are under him. He spreadeth sharp pointing things upon the mire. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh the path to shine after him. One would think the deep to be hoary. Behold, verse 34, in a very all-encompassing statement. He beholdeth all high things. He is a king over all the children of pride. Now that last statement shows exactly how this term is going to be used in the future. He is a king over all the children of pride. His qualities have been evidenced, and he's now used in that symbol as a king over all the children of pride. Now there were creatures of the sea, obviously, who fitted the bill. If you turn to Psalm 104... I think it's David, but we can't perhaps prove that. But in Psalm 104, when the psalmist reviews the oceans, he does use the term there. He says in verse 25, so is this great and wide sea, wherein are things creeping innumerable, both small and great beasts. There go the ships, there is that Leviathan, whom thou hast made to play therein. There are expressions in Job 41 that indicated that he was related to the seas as a turbulent and rousing monster in the seas. And this psalm says that he plays in the sea. So he was obviously a creature of the sea. Now, looking at the other terms back in Isaiah 27, the next one is those two references, isn't it, to the serpent, the piercing serpent, the crooked serpent. Piercing meaning that he was swift, and crooked meaning that he was winding or twisting, which is a fearful attitude of the serpent, isn't it? Now, we don't need to go back to Genesis 3 to establish the connection of the serpent with sin. We all know that story very well. Right from the beginning in our Bibles, that is the source of sin. The connotation is well known to us, the original source of temptation. The crooked, lying, carnal thoughts of the serpent became embedded into the hearts of men and have lain there ever since. So that is linked, you see, with Leviathan. Now there's a joining together of those principles. So what is true of the serpent then is connoted also with the Leviathan. And what Leviathan has is linked also with the serpent, you see. It's all brought together. And the third thing mentioned is the dragon that is in the sea. Now, what do you think that means? Are the Chinese right? Are they really dragons that breathe fire and brimstone, as they depict so much in their artistic work? Well, the Hebrew for the word dragon is the word tannin, T-A-N-N-I-N. Nothing to do with smoking. Tannin. Got something dragon has got something to do with smoking. Now, where's that word tannin used? Well, it's used in Genesis. Come back to Genesis chapter 1. This is the word that is used here for whales. In Genesis 1 and verse 21, it's the word tannin. Same word exactly that's translated dragon in Isaiah 27 verse 1, which is intriguing, isn't it? God created great tannin, an ever-living creature that moveth. So obviously it was a creature of the sea, created for that purpose. Translated there as whales. If you turn with me to Psalm 148, have a look at a number of references. In Psalm 148 in verse 7, praise Yahweh from the earth, ye dragons and all deeps. So there again is the sense of Genesis 1 and verse 21. But it's being used as a great creature of the seas. In Psalm 91, we are told there that it has the power of death. Psalm 91 and verse 13. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder. There's our snake again, see, our serpent. The lion, a deadly creature. The young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. There's our word tannin again. So it's very interesting to see how the word is used in these different passages. You would not suspect, perhaps, that it was the same word as what you had for whales in Genesis 1 verse 21. Now, this word is used particularly of some powers. Let's have a look at those. For example, Psalm 74. In Psalm 74 it is used of the power of Egypt. Psalm 74 and verse 12, for God is my king of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters. Now that's a comment upon the past, when Israel were delivered out of the sea into the promised land. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons of the tannin in the waters. Were there dragons in the waters? Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces, and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness. Thou didst cleave the fountain of the flood. Thou didst drive up mighty rivers. Now it wasn't the fish in the Red Sea that was the problem, was it? What God broke was the power of Egypt. And so in Psalm 74, it's being spoken of here as the dragon. The power of Egypt is therefore related to the word dragon. In Isaiah 51, the same thing. In Isaiah 51 and verse 9, awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake as in the ancient days and the generations of old. Art thou not it that hath cut Rahab and wounded the dragon? Rahab is another word for Egypt. So Rahab and dragon, or Rahab and Egypt, are being made equivalent to the dragon, which is what we found in Psalm 74 as well. Now again in Ezekiel chapter 29. Showing that the word tannin is particularly related to certain powers, and Egypt is the first of those. Ezekiel 29 and verse 3, speak and say, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, behold, I am against thee, the Pharaoh king of Egypt, the great dragon that lieth in the midst of his rivers, which hath said, my river is mine own, and I have made it for myself. So that helps too in the sense of Psalm 74, doesn't it? That it's not in Psalm 74 just talking about some creatures that happened to be in the Red Sea at that time, who perhaps got plagued in two as the waters divided. Not talking about that at all. It's talking about the power that held Israel at that time, which of course was the power of Egypt. All right, now it's also used of Babylon in Jeremiah chapter 51. Jeremiah 51. And verse 34. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, hath devoured me. He hath crushed me. He hath made me an empty vessel. He hath swallowed me up like a dragon. He hath filled his belly with my delicates. He hath cast me out. So there we have a reference to Babylon. Now, of course, the thinking of Egypt comes through Babylon, doesn't it? But the thinking of Babylon then goes on to Persia and to Greece and to Rome. And so we have those references, like we saw in Revelation 12. Let's just go back there again. In Revelation chapter 12, just to pick up the story, where the Roman power is described in chapter 12 and verse 3 as a great red dragon, as it is also in chapter 12 and verse 9, or again in chapter 12 and verse 17, the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So Babylon, or rather Egypt, Babylon and Rome have all had the epithet of the dragon applied to them, because the thinking of one has gone through to the other, has gone right through to the end. And they're not unrelated, are they? Just keeping your hand there, turn to Revelation chapter 11. Here in Revelation 11 and verse 8, the connotation is very clear. Revelation 11 verse 8, and their bodies, their dead bodies, shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt. The great city is the great city of Rome. And there, her connotation is with Egypt. Interesting, isn't it? That Rome has a relationship to Egypt. That's what the Bible's teaching there. And as we well know, Rome has a relationship to Babylon, because in the 17th chapter of Revelation, Rome is called Great Babylon. Revelation 17 and verse 5. So the Bible picks up these echoes of this, well, single power, this multi-headed power through the years that has persecuted the people of God. Revelation 17 and verse 5, upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Mother of harlots. So she is now bearing the title of Babylon that goes right down back through all those years, back to Egypt. And it was given there the configuration of the dragon by the prophets many years ago. And just while we're close by in Revelation, two passages which show very beautifully the relationship of that power to his own people. Revelation chapter 12 and the last verse. This is why Yahweh brings out his sore and strong sword. This is the day of rectification. 12 verse 17, the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And it's been long needed that God should stand up with his sword and expunge the strength of that power, that this faithful group might be vindicated for their loyalty to God in all those circumstances. For Revelation 17, where in verse 5 we had that description about this Babylon the Great carried on all the wickedness of Babylon of old and brought it to a higher sense of development of fruition. In verse 6, God remembers his people. Here's the relationship. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. It's a very violent, wicked system that needs a strong and powerful sword to deal it a fatal blow. And so Isaiah 27 is saying exactly that, that the time has come when God will destroy that very power. He will do so with his sore and great and strong sword. Now, if we then speak about that in a summary way, my dear brothers and sisters, where all of those figures, dragons, serpents and Leviathan, are all brought together, right? Then the time that will happen, of course, is the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. And it therefore is exceedingly interesting to turn to Revelation chapter 20, which is the very chapter which deals with exactly that. And we see that that chapter opens as though Isaiah 27 was just poured into the opening verses of it. Revelation chapter 20 and verse 1. I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. This is Christ coming to chain sin, to disenfranchise the powers of this world, to come with his great sword, if you like, in another sense. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. In our terms of Isaiah 27, that's the serpent, the dragon, the Leviathan, who by a sword and great sword Yahweh has put to an end. What will that sword be? Is it a sword? Do you imagine Christ coming with a sword in his hand? Got you. Here's one for someone else. Do you imagine it to be like that? Christ have an actual sword in his hand? In the 2 Thessalonians, I think we have the sword described. Second Thessalonians chapter 2. Verse 8, speaking about the Roman power. In fact, this is absolutely analogous to Isaiah 27. It says in verse 8, then shall the wicked one be revealed, the lawless one, the anomos, without law, be revealed. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. Then shall the wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. So the sword is the spirit of his mouth by which he will deal a fatal blow to that system. I don't imagine that he would need to use more than his vocal expression. He shall speak and it shall be done. So there in just one verse of Isaiah 27 are connotations all over the Bible, which are all brought together in this most remarkable way and find their wonderful echo in Revelation chapter 20. You see how this truly is the little apocalypse, isn't it? That's what we said about Isaiah 24 to 27. You can see that that is exactly right. All the connotations just run straight through into the book of Revelation. Now, coming back to Isaiah chapter 27, we're going to deal with the vineyard. Now, the second vision, which is seen in this chapter, down to verse 6. In that day, sing ye unto her a vineyard of red wine. I, Yahweh, do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. Now, the word for red wine is really one word. It's the word kemer. The word red is not there, and the word wine is not there. It's just the word kemer. And it seems that that word has the sense of maturation. Or in terms of wine, it would be fermentation. Ever seen a vineyard of red wine? Ever seen a vineyard of mature wine? You see leaves, don't you? Grapes, boughs of the vine. You don't see a vineyard of fermentation. The point is, the prophet's saying that this is fruitful. He hasn't described how many acres, he hasn't described what type it is, whether it's Shiraz or Moselle or whatever it might be. He hasn't described any of those things, as he does in chapter 5. He hasn't described whether there's a border around the edges. None of those things are described. He just looks at it and with one expression, it's realised its purpose. It has come to fruition. Sing unto her a vineyard of red wine, a vineyard of maturation, of fruition and ferment, as the word seems to imply. So This is a very great contrast with another vineyard over which a song was made earlier in chapter 5. But I just want you to notice that verse 3 emphasises the constant care, both in the sense of protection, our Yahweh do keep it, and in the sense of watering of the vineyard. I will water it every moment. He who keeps Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps, does he? As Psalm 121 says. So he will keep it, end of verse 3, night and day. Now the echoes of that are very clear, aren't they? Keep our hand there and come back to chapter 5. In chapter 5, interestingly, very interestingly, there's another little song that was being sung. Isaiah 5. Now will I sing, says Isaiah, to my well-beloved, who I believe is Yahweh here, a song of my beloved, touching his vineyard. And that my beloved there may perhaps be Israel. You might notice in Isaiah 27 and verse 2 that this is sung, this song to her. I will sing to her. Who's the her? Well, I should think it would be Israel. The second little song is sung to Israel, like this one is sung here in chapter 5 about Israel. Isn't that interesting? That in Isaiah we have got two little songs about a vineyard directed towards Israel. Now look at the contrasts. The state of the land is told in verse 1. It's a very fruitful place. The defences, verse 2. He gathered out the stones. It was the best type of strain of vine that he could find, verse 2. The vine of Sorek, as it is in the original. He built a tower in the midst of it. There was a wine press there as well, so it could be readily put to use. And he looked that it should bring forth grapes, as it brought, and it brought forth wild grapes. All the details, none of that detail, is in chapter 27 and verse 1. And he says in verse 3, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray, betwixt me and my vineyard. What could have been done more to my vineyard than I have done unto it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. There was no fruition, no fermentation. It was not a vineyard of red wine. It never brought forth what it was planted for. And now go to, verse 5, says God, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down, and I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned nor digged. But there shall come up briars and thorns, and I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looked for judgment. Behold, oppression for righteousness. But behold, a cry. Cry of the oppressed." Look at the difference. How many differences do you notice there? One vineyard is fruitful, the other is unfruitful. One vineyard God watered, and now he says, I will water it no more. I will command the clouds that they rain no more upon it. With one, he says in chapter 27 that he will keep it night and day and care for it. With the other, he says, I will lay it waste. The briars and thorns can come up. I'll take away the hedge, verse 5, and allow the Gentile to come in over their borders and devour them. And so we've got briars and thorns in verse 6 of chapter 5, and in 27 and verse 4, God sets himself against the briars and thorns, which of course are the enemies of Israel. So the two are really intriguing, aren't they? That in Isaiah you've got these two entirely different. And the former must obviously come before the latter of chapter 27. This one is associated with resurrection and the coming of the Lord. There is going to be a wonderful new Israeli vineyard established. Do you like vineyards? There's nobody in any place, I suppose, could appreciate vineyards more than a South Australian, could they? We really see the vineyard exactly like it's in Israel. Everything else is dry around, dry hills, dry climate. That's what they like. and yet the vine will settle in there, and in the middle of summer it showers these beautiful leaves and brings forth wonderful fruit. We irrigate them today, I know, but in times past they didn't irrigate them, but they still brought forth their fruit. Very deep-rooted plants are the vineyards, and they're lovely, aren't they? There's orderliness about a vineyard, something very comely about it. It's green, and it's orderly, and it's lasting. Vineyards last for 400 or 500 years. In France, there are vineyards that they're still using that have been there all those years, and they're better with the years, aren't they? There's a maturation, as it were, with the years. Now, of course, that's always been associated with Israel. Quickly come back to Judges chapter 9, which I think might be the first reference. It's in Jotham's parable. Three trees were likened to Israel, and Jotham mentions each one of them. Judges chapter 9. The trees went forth, verse 8, on a tune to anoint a king over them. And they said unto the olive tree, reign thou over us. But the olive said, should I leave my fatness? Then they approached the fig tree, verse 10, Judges 9, come thou and reign over us. But the fig tree said unto them, should I forsake my sweetness and my good fruit? And then finally they came to the vine, verse 12, not finally, but next they came to the vine. Then said the trees unto the vine, come thou and reign over us. And the vine said unto them, should I leave my wine, which cheereth God and man, and go to be promoted over the trees? So fig and olive, or olive and fig and vine, those three are the three which are used to symbolise Israel. What's singular about those three trees? What's unique about those three? Unique? Well, what's common to them all? Can I ask a question? How many pieces of furniture have you got home that are made out of olive trees? Or out of fig trees? Or out of vines? How many pieces of furniture, how many chairs have you got made out of vine trees? So when you think about it, those three trees are perfectly useless, aren't they, for anything else than their fruit. Delicious fruit. Absolutely beautiful. Every one of them, extremely beautiful in their own sense, right? They have a secret, each one of them. But in terms of other uses, only for fruit. And without that fruit, then they are in fact of no use whatsoever. Now, the key passage that really expanded this theme is Psalm 80. This is a key passage. Did you notice that hymn that we sung tonight? Isn't that a beautiful hymn? What number is it? 36. Well, that's all about Psalm 80. Beautiful hymn. Well played, too, by Brother Shaw tonight. A lovely hymn indeed. Psalm 80. Turn us again, O God of hosts, and cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved. This psalm's full of that. Then it goes back to God's original purpose. Thou hast brought a vine out of Egypt. Thou hast cast out the heathen and planted it. Thou preparest room before it. So here's the vineyard being prepared, like Isaiah 5. It's the same story, just a few different details, that's all. Isaiah's no doubt borrowing from Psalm 80. Thou preparest room before it, didst cause it to take root, filled the land. The hills were covered with the shadow of it, and the boughs thereof were like the goodly cedar. She sent out her boughs unto the sea, and her branches unto the river. Why hast thou then broken down her hedges? That's chapter 5 of Isaiah, isn't it? So did all they which pass by the way do pluck her. The boar out of the wood doth waste it, and the wild beast of the field doth devour. But that's Isaiah 5 again. Return, we beseech thee, O God of hosts, look down from heaven and behold and visit this vine and the vineyard which thy right hand hath planted and the branch that thou madest strong for thyself. What can be done to this vine? What's lacking in this vine? That God has done all this for it, but it still cannot produce what it was in fact intended to be. What is wrong? Didn't Isaiah ask that same question? He said, what more could be done unto this, my vine? You know there's an answer to that. What's the answer? Turn to Mark chapter 12. Here's the answer. In Mark 12, this is the parable which quotes the song of Isaiah chapter 5. The parable of the vineyard. Mark 12, verse 1. A certain man planted a vineyard and set a hedge about it, and digged a place for the wine vat, and built a tower, and let it out to husband, and went into a far country. That's all Isaiah 5, isn't it? The whole lot of it. This is based upon Isaiah 5. What was the question of the Spirit? The question of the Spirit was, what more could be done? Right? Well, he sent servant upon servant. He sent another one, verse 5, and many others, verse 5, beating some and killing some. What more could be done to my vine? Having yet therefore one son. That's the answer to Isaiah 5 and verse 4. That's the answer. Having yet therefore one son, his well-beloved, peculiar and significantly different, the Son of God, he sent him also last unto them, saying, they will reverence my son. He's the Lord of the vineyard's son. He owns the place. Now look at Psalm 80. That's what this psalm also says. The vineyard which thy right hand hath planted. Psalm 80 and verse 15. Look down from heaven and behold and visit this vine and all of its wretchedness. And the vineyard which thy right hand hath planted, and the branch that thou madest strong for thyself, it is burned with fire, it is cut down, they perish at the rebuke of thy countenance. The boars of the Gentiles rush over their borders and do what they like. Verse 17, here's the answer. What more can be done? Let thy hand be upon the man, the ish of thy right hand. And he'll come from there, won't he? Upon the son of man whom thou madest strong for thyself. There's the answer. So will we not go back from thee. Quicken us and we will call upon thy name. What's the vine need? What's the vineyard need? With all the opportunities it's had and lost, what that vineyard is desperately in need of is the Son of God. God to come into that nation and redeem it from all of its iniquity. And without that, it will never come to its fruition. What's the difference between Isaiah 5 and Isaiah 27? Just that. In Isaiah 5, it is without the Son of God. In Isaiah 27, it is a fruitful vine because the true vine has been sown. And people can therefore be grafted into that true vine and they can find their way to salvation and fruitfulness because he is the Lord of the vineyard. He is the Father's Son. The one made strong for deliverance and salvation. Made strong by God. Now, my dear brothers and sisters, this is delightful. Come to John chapter 15. With all that background running through our mind, just look what Jesus says in John 15. Are we here this evening, my dear brothers and sisters, by ourselves, or is our Master aware of it? As we consider a chapter like John 15, which is absolutely thrilling, which he got on this very vein, this note of interest, and he expounded it so beautifully for us. In John 15 and verse 1 he says, I am the true vine and my Father is the husbandman. He owns the place and I'm the true vine. What was the problem with chapter 5? Sour grapes. Wild grapes. You couldn't get anything decent out of that vineyard. But this is the planting of Sorek, as it were. This is the true vine that will provide the right taste and flavour, that will bring life into that vineyard and life to those who partake of it. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, prunes it, that it may bring forth more fruit. He wants fruitfulness. And unless that branch, you and I, are in that true vine, we will never bring forth eternal life. We will never bring forth the fruits of the Spirit. Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. But stay in me, he says. Abide in me. And I in you. Don't let there be a gap between where the branch starts and the vine ends. Stay engrafted into that true vine. Abide in me and I in you. You're clean for the moment, but stay in there. And I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye, except ye abide in me. And you know, when that's being said to the apostles, and all around him as the Jewish nation, my dear brothers, those words are absolutely amazing, aren't they? That little group, see? That little group that are being grafted into him. And outside are all the Jewish people, about to, with the lights on to all kinds of hours at night, plotting his death to bring down the true vine. And he's saying to them, you stay in me. There is only one vine flavour. There's only one type of grape, as it were, that's going to bring the salvation that men need. And if they haven't got that, then they might as well be plucked off. All the rest counts for nothing. Whatever was planted when God brought it out of Egypt, that will not count. This is the true vine. And it having been established in that good soil, men must be grafted into it. I am the vine. Ye are the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. But without me, ye can do nothing. And that's Israel today, my dear brothers and sisters. Isn't that a tragedy? What's the difference between Israel today and Israel in the kingdom? Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the earth with fruit. What's the difference? The difference is they haven't got Christ. They haven't got the Son of God. God has stepped aside from that vineyard. He started again with the true vine. And if they don't graft themselves in it, they'll have nothing. You know, I was at dinner not so long ago in a Jewish company. And this man, who you would actually know who he is, because he's been to a number of our Israeli nights. And he was telling me, you know, if only the world would make peace with Israel, they've got so much to gain. I said, truly? Oh, I said, Israel could do wonders for the world. I thought, you know, what a thing to say, apart from anything else. What kind of a head does that reflect? I mean, aren't they just mortal people like all the rest of the nations? Of course they are. But you see, he thinks, nice chapter, mate, he thinks that just because he's an Israelite, that therefore has got a special gift to the world. And Jesus says that unless you are in me, that'll be taken and burnt up and consumed. Outside that vine, it's useless. It'll bring forth no fruit. You've got to be in the Son of God. You've got to be in the one whom he made strong for himself. I heard a most amazing radio program recently. It was beamed out of Melbourne when we were on our holiday. And God was on trial. And the trial was, it's a bit large Jewish convention. The ABC went along on it. Transferred it to all the world to hear. Swift, sharp Jewish minds. And God was on trial because of Auschwitz. I tell you, my dear friends, it was spine tingling to listen to that. As Jew vied with Jew to try and explain the Holocaust. How do you explain the Holocaust? There's only one way to explain the Holocaust, and that is that if the branches are not grafted into the true vine that God put in there, then they're of no value. They'll be taken and burnt. And for 1900 years, they've been burnt until Eichmann came along and burnt them in the most dramatic way. And they still couldn't understand. And they called against God. And in Melbourne in 1994, the last day of Melbourne, it was 1995, early days of 1995, they're debating and calling God in question. They put God in the dock, the God of Israel. Wouldn't 1900 years of reversal of the boar running through the vineyard, wouldn't that tell them that something very great has happened, that God is displeased with? Verse 6, if a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered, and men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. I just quickly show the relationship of that to Isaiah chapter 27, the last two verses. God says in verse 4, a fury is not in me, Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? That is, the Gentile powers that were against him. Fury is not in me. God has turned with warmth of heart towards his people. I have no wrath, it says the RSV. I have no wrath. Would the briars and thorns contend against me in battle? I will go through the Gentiles. I would burn them together. That is, I'd use my great and sore and strong sword. I would burn them together. Is that John 15? It is, isn't it? It's John 15, all right. Or let him take hold of my strength, as Jacob did of old, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. That is, if the Gentile, rather than contend with me, wants rather to come and embrace my strength, then I will make peace with him. Peace, peace, says God, to him that is near and to him that is afar off. Those are the words of the 57th chapter, aren't they? Verse 19 and 20. And verse 6, if they, the Gentiles, would combine with his people, then verse 6, they would enjoy the same blessings. He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. And of that, my dear brothers and sisters, we will say just a little bit more in our class next week.
I'd like to thank Brother Brian for his talk this evening, and there is about 5 minutes for questions or any comments.
I'd like to ask a question, Brother. The verses 4 and 5 are still not clear in my mind, really, where they fit in. Like verse 3, it's talking about the vineyard. Where did the briars and the thorns come into it? And it's not quite clear now.
That's because I'm rushed through it. Just paraphrasing it then, verse 4. Fury is not in me. That is God's statement of goodwill towards his people. I have no wrath, says the RSV. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. That's chapter 40, verse 1 and 2. I think that's the key to verse 4. So it's a time in which he's speaking comfortably to his people. And so in verse 4, there is suggested a confrontation of other powers. Who would set the briars and thorns against me? Now, they're used in chapter 5 as the Gentile powers that come up in the vineyard when the wild boar knocks down its hedges. Verse 6, I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. Well, would they set themselves against God? If he speaks now peaceably to Israel, would it be the Gentiles that they are going to take on God? Indeed, God is resolute in that. He will deal with them. I will go through them. I would burn them together. But I can speak peaceably to him too. Here's an alternative. Rather than confront me, verse 5, let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me. So if he doesn't want confrontation, then here is an invitation to the Gentile to make peace with him, as Jacob did of old. I think verse 5 is actually playing John upon Jacob of old, who wrestled with God all night, and then when he was struck in the hollow of his thigh and knew his weakness, he turned around and he held on to God. He wouldn't let him go. Let him take hold of my strength. You know, he was those, like those of verse 6, he shall cause them that come of Jacob. He was of the Jacob spirit, because he, though a Gentile, clung hold of God and would not let him go. He would know God's strength, not his own, know God's strength. Verse 4, therefore, it conjures the Gentiles using their own strength, or verse 5, that they can know God's strength and cling onto that. And if they will, then he will make peace with them, as also he would with Israel in verse 4, fury is not in me. It's a time of making peace, if they would. Otherwise, he would go through them. Is that more helpful? There are other references in Isaiah 57, so pertinent. I just paraphrased it before. Chapter 57. The double use of the word peace is found again in 57, verse 19. I create the fruit of the lips. Peace, peace to him that is far off, that's the Gentile, and to him that is near, that's the Jew, saith Yahweh, and I will heal him.